Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 11th, 2016. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone. Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, and first off, I'm going to set the show up here in about 20 minutes. Coming back for the second time, one of our favorite guests from last time, Glenn Thrush of Politico. Glenn's agreed to come back on. Very excited to have him come back on. He's got one of the top political podcasts, and if it's not the top rated, it, I believe, has the best guest list of any podcast, political out there. And the fact that we have him on our show hopefully helps our guest list out a bit. But let me start out, and you know, every time I say the date, and I do that just so people listening kind of get a sense of when the show is from – you know, when they're listening, be it sometime this week or if they listen to it, 5 months from now. And it usually doesn't. The date's just the date. I've even gotten it wrong before. But this time it's September 11th, 2016, the 15-year anniversary of 9/11. And it hit on a Sunday. And I was at the football game. And typically when a football game gets political, it's not a good thing. My experience, or any kind of social event, it gets political, not a good thing. Well, I was at the game, and of course, there's been a lot of talk about different players protesting the national anthem based on more domestic issues, really nothing to do with military things. Well, the NFL seemingly must have had the president do a short speech about 9/11 and how it's a time to come together. And it played in the Georgia Dome. I don't know if it played elsewhere, but Tim was telling me it did play at other stadiums. I thought it was just an excellent, inclusive speech that brought people together. I was at the Dome, and I saw people that I'm pretty sure just looking, didn't vote for President Obama. Odds are they received the speech really well. Everybody at the Georgia Dome seemingly stood, the players, the coaches, everything, because the moment was created where it was more of a togetherness America moment, not a divisive, separate America moment. And I thought the president did a great job, and I thought the NFL did a good job by getting the president in and wrapping it with some other things they did there in Atlanta. So I just wanted to share that with y'all because I was there. Tim, you saw it on TV. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, it was about the same thing. It seemed to be very moving, But apparently they've shown this film at every stadium, introducing it and, followed in some places by a moment of silence, followed immediately by the national anthem in other places. And, very stirring ceremonies, very patriotic all over the NFL today. Really, really nice touch and really an excellent little heart-to-heart talk by the president. Very, very nice. Very good.
Yeah, I think even some of his detractors who like to say thanks, Obama, might actually say thanks, President Obama, which is a little bit
right.
The tone. Catherine, did you happen to see or hear about this?
No, of course. I pay almost no attention to sports. And if I'd known about it, I probably would have taken the, few minutes to listen to it, but I didn't even hear about it. But I'm glad the president did it, and I'm glad it sounds like it was a unifying moment, and I think we really need that right now.
Catherine, I imagine you will have no problem at all finding that somewhere on the internet tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure I will listen to it at about 8 o'clock
very,
tonight.
Very, very nice. Very good.
Yes. Well, while that was going on, another story hit, the news. And I happened to look at Political Wire one time. I wasn't even planning on looking at it much, being at the game, but I looked by, and it was like three stories, and I double-checked it with CNN. Now, this is something that's been lingering on a long time, and it's something we really hadn't addressed because it was certainly a lot of hokum. And very well, I think a lot of hokum's going to come out of this with Hillary Clinton's help. We obviously saw the National Enquirer picture that was so doctored. It was more doctored than the Time cover of O.J. Simpson. And it just made up out of whole cloth. But Hillary Clinton did seemingly I hadn't even described it because I didn't see the footage like Tim did. Tim, why don't I just throw to you and you describe what you saw?
Yeah, I was actually watching it as it unfolded. About an hour and a half, I guess, into the 9/11 event this morning, and I've been watching the whole thing on C-SPAN from the time they got there and started, you know, just milling around and stuff like that. You know how the C-SPAN cameras will play around, and, you know, I saw her on several occasions, and she looked fine. She was wearing dark glasses, but that didn't seem to be all. But about an hour and a half into the event, I guess it was, what I found out later, actually, just a few minutes before she was scheduled to leave the thing, Secretary Clinton abruptly left the event. They didn't even tell her protected media who, you know, the little core of media that travels around everywhere with her, like even on her plane and everything else, the people from the major networks, they didn't even know she was gone. She just left. And then a few minutes after that, footage emerged of her at a curb about to get into her SUV. The cameras were behind her. And she looked as if she wobbled and her knees buckled. And two Secret Service agents got on either side of her and helped her into the SUV. She had a couple of female aides with her, and off she went. We found out a few minutes later to Chelsea's apartment, which was nearby. Sometime later, she came out, and she seemed fine. She was waving to people. It was like you were looking at a different person, or like the Energizer Bunny had gotten a dose of something, you know, and she was fine. She was hollering, "I'm fine, beautiful day, this and that and the other." And somebody got her attention off to her right, and a little girl walked up to her and apparently asked to have her picture taken with her. So she turned the little girl around, faced the camera, and they took a picture, and she spoke to her, and then got in her vehicle and left. I understand she was going to her house. And then a statement was released that said that she had, quote, overheated, and that she was fine. And then, not long before we went on the air this evening, her doctor released a statement that said for a few days he has been treating her for pneumonia, had advised her to slow her schedule down, had advised her not to go to that event this morning. Of course, she kept her schedule, and she went to that event anyway and probably should not have done so, having had pneumonia myself. I can appreciate that. So that's basically it, David. And as far as the sideline stuff, you know, that's just something we'll have to see about. That's the way it went down today.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, a lot of it will be how people react. We know there's a group of people, and I think I told y'all this is going to be kerosene for their fire. They didn't really need anything to want to burn their fire, but, man, they're going to point to this. There's other people that are going to believe, you know, nothing. And then there's going to be, you know, the swing voter middle and how that affects could be a factor. Catherine, you know, if you want to discuss the health side, that's fine. Or if you'd rather discuss the political side, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I'm sorry that that Secretary Clinton is not feeling well. She has one crazy, hectic schedule, and I think anyone, even someone 25 years younger than her, would struggle with that schedule. It's crazy. And I always think, you know, you should probably should have listened to your doctor and maybe not gone. She also went to a fundraiser last night that was co-hosted by Barbara Streisand, and they're saying, well, she probably shouldn't have gone to that, but she went to that. I mean, who would not go to she and Barbara Streisand are friends, and Barbara Streisand is a longtime supporter. Of course she's going to go to that. So, I mean, I think it's difficult, always difficult to resist when you have a busy schedule to pick and choose the things that you're not going to attend or the things that you might skip. So, again, I'm sorry that she's not feeling well. I hope she feels better very soon. Many people get pneumonia and recover 100%. Most people recover 100%. She's under doctor's care. Let's just leave her alone. I just don't understand why this is such a big deal. Her doctor says, you know, they gave all the stats on her, you know, she's had her annual physical, this is her blood pressure, this is her cholesterol, you know, she's had all her tests. I mean, they reported that today. So, I mean, unless we don't trust her doctors, but, I mean, I don't know, I just think it's a lot of hype. And I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
People are going to, you know, make hay of it, or they're going to be very defensive of her. I just think there's a lot of other important things to talk about. And I wish that on both sides we would spend, I mean, we all wish this, we'd spend more time talking about the issues and policies that really affect American citizens and our international circumstances rather than, a bout of pneumonia that was probably she's probably almost recovered from because they've been giving her antibiotics, and I think she was probably needed hydration today. I'm betting.
Yeah, that's what it was.
I bet when she went to Chelsea, she drank some water, she got some vitamins, and that made her much better. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I'm out in the heat, that happens to me. I don't faint, but you get a little overheated, and you take a break, you drink some water, you relax a little, and you feel better. So,
hey, if she's smart, she'd have drunk a Gatorade and a Powerade, and if she comes in and hits the trail hard, she can sell the commercial rights to the highest bidder, you know, because she had both. We don't know which one rejuvenated her for the long fight ahead. You know, if you
yeah, well, David,
out of this.
David, I've never met a politician in my life that would slow down one inch in the middle of a campaign at any level, no matter what was going on with it.
Exactly.
You know, that's the way they
well,
all
are.
That's the way they're wired.
Yeah, well, and you can see, like, if I can make it to that point, I can rest after that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you win the presidency, there's not that much rest. But I want to kind of pull it back into a bigger macro issue, and that would just be, you know, how healthy does a person have to be president? You hear, you know, Donald Trump, all these claims, I'm the healthiest person to ever run for president. I think Donald Trump's health is not an issue. It's his statements he makes. I mean, I don't think he's the healthiest person ever to run for president or the healthiest 70-year-old running around or whatever it is. This is a 70-year-old something man and a woman in her late 60s. I don't think you're picking either of them for your Spartan team race. You know, and what is that bar that you have to pass to be president? You know, it's – and I no one's really defined that anyway. I think a lot of times if the person agrees with you on issues, their health becomes a lot less important. If they disagree with you on the issues – their health becomes a whole lot more important, whether you're Democrat or Republican. Would y'all agree with that statement?
I'll be honest.
I don't really think about it much.
With you, David, if I can. The American people have a funny way of deciding what is and is not important. You know, you've heard it a million times. If we'd have had television then and news coverage then like we do now, we might have never elected Franklin Roosevelt because he was in a wheelchair. And yeah, people are going to use this as a political football. They will use anything as a political football. They've used everything from where the present president was born to Mitt Romney's dog to John McCain's adopted daughter. And, of course, they're going to throw bombs at Secretary Clinton as having something that probably 75% of us in our lives have had at some point, including when we were young, healthy kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just one of those things. She called for a bunch of days, and they thought she had allergies, and it turned out when they examined her the other day that, no, she had walking pneumonia, so.
Yeah, and this is another double standard with president, is in every other walk of life, you've got a medical issue. Maybe sports is another place where this is the same way for this double standard. You have HIPAA rules. HIPAA rules get tighter and tighter. No one's allowed to ask about your health. It's not your business. You're running for office or you play sports, I guess at a professional level, it becomes everybody's business.
Right.
You know, right or wrong.
That's because we put these people up on a pedestal, and we want them to be perfect and better than everybody else. We want them to be something special. We want them to be Superman and Superwoman. No, they can't get sick like normal people or our professional athletes. No, they can't have failings like a regular person would playing the same game, but they do because they're as human as we are.
Yeah, I mean, I just see that double standard. Well, let's try to get at one quick issue maybe before Glenn calls in here, and that would be the Minnesota ballot. Now, I think I sent y'all a message right before the filing deadline that Donald Trump and or the Minnesota Republican Party had not done the paperwork for him to be on the ballot, and it looked like there was really not enough time in that period for him to make the ballot. Now the DFL is suing so he won't make the, you know, so he won't appear on the ballot. Tim, kind of tell us how that timeline closed.
Well,
getting on there.
What finally it came down to is that the DFL has now filed a petition in the state Supreme Court to have Trump removed from the ballot. And it's based on the failure of the Republican Party to properly choose their electors for the Electoral College, which they are supposed to do either in a state Republican Party meeting or their convention. And I hope there's going to be an expedited ruling on this, guys, because absentee ballots go out on the 23rd of September up there. So, they better get to doing something in a hurry. I couldn't imagine them keeping him off the ballot, but you never know. You never know.
Yeah, so Catherine and I, of course, we learned this in government civics back in high school. You don't vote for president. You vote for a slate of electors. Sounds like they didn't put the electors on the ballot, so therefore you can't vote for that slate of electors. It's actually not Donald Trump's name, correct?
Well, I mean, we still vote for the – I mean, we don't vote for electors in Georgia.
Well, you do in theory. Now, obviously, nobody –
In theory,
well,
but they're not on the ballot.
John Jones. Yeah, but, yeah, they're somewhere that you can find out those lists of people, which shows you how dumb, in my opinion, the Electoral College is.
Well, I think this is I'll be interested. I don't know if I'll make the effort to check it out, but I would be interested to learn who is serving in the Republican Party in Minnesota, whether they're new, not necessarily the far right, the alt right people, but who's serving and if there's any continuity of information. So this sounds like a rookie mistake, right? Like maybe they have a whole bunch of new people in their party that don't know the rules. I mean, we're really lucky in the Democratic Party in Georgia that we have new people and we have consistent people that have been around for longer, and the information is passed along so that we all know, so that the people who have to do these things know what to do. I mean, it's basically Mike Jablonski, but whatever. Right? I mean, he's been doing it for a long time,
yeah.
And he's very generous in his time and information. So, but if they have a bunch of new people that got, you know, elected or appointed in their party, this is exactly the kind of thing that has to be done by the party. And a lot of people don't understand the number of, you know, sort of administrative and legal hoops that have to be, or rules that have to be met in order to be, in order for the ballot to be right and for the party to be legitimate and all those things. And so this is an example of what can happen. Again, I don't know what happened, but I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, that's just one of the basics you have to do. You have to get your candidates on the ballot. I mean, you know, I know that running for president, you know, when these guys, you know, or ladies decide to run for president, they think, oh, I got this. Getting on the ballot is kind of step one. Don't raise $1 million. You know, don't get a phone tree list of thousands of names. Make sure you're on the ballot, because the rest of it's moot if you can't do that. And you think that that's really probably more the Republican Party's job than the Donald Trump campaign. Honestly, now, if Donald Trump's campaign was a little more traditionally organized, they could have checked those things and verified to help a state party that didn't do their job. But, and you got to think, Minnesota Republicans, how well could they be doing? Now, of course, they could say, hey, Georgia Democrat, talk to me about it. But they've got a Democratic governor, two Democratic senators, and they hadn't voted for a Republican for president in I don't know how many cycles. They're one of those states that are just, you know, locked down. Jim?
A big but. You know what Trump's been saying, how they're going to steal it from him? Could you imagine the howling that would come from his campaign if this happened?
Well, I mean, get on the ballot.
I mean, he
agree.
Would go. He
I
would
really
go
don't
want
to beat him.
See, this
there,
folks,
is not the way
I
to
beat him. Doing. That's what he would say.
Yeah.
That's what he would
yeah,
say.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would rather beat him at the ballot box so there's nothing he can say, or any of his black
right.
belt people or any other
right.
folks they can find. But, I mean, they do have to follow the legal process.
That's
right
true.
Now, if stood right now, there was no court ruling, no, would he be on the ballot, or would his elector slate be on the ballot or not? Kim, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the state Supreme Court's going to do up there, but I don't know what to say about this. This doesn't come up every day, you know. I mean, I remember when Lyndon Johnson was left off the ballot in Alabama in 1964, but obviously that was done on purpose. By state officials over there, you know, this thing here is just a dumb, like Catherine said, a dumb rookie mistake, probably by some mid-level kid that just didn't think about it, and so you know,
and the other thing is nobody in the the Trump campaign is a bunch of rookies too, and they didn't have.
Well, they never.
I mean, I'm sure that most of these campaigns have a person that is responsible for making sure that all those ballot issues are resolved.
But as you said, Catherine, that's traditional campaigns that
right,
do
exactly.
that. This is Trump.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what happens here. I mean, this is not a real state that I'm sure Donald Trump or the Republicans are targeting. It's just such an embarrassment. Obviously, then will be a state that Hillary Clinton could just completely ignore. Maybe doing it anyway. It's not like neither one of the Senate seats are up there. I don't know. There might be, I think, one or two House seats in the northern part of the state we need to defend,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think the presidential campaign is going to be what does that. Another effort will have to do that. Well, let's continue to move on, and that would be, I want to move on to that poll that we saw out of Louisiana. It showed that Louisiana was, I believe, a 6-point race, and we'll try to the thing I never could find, you know, many numbers on it, but it was, to me, such a fascinating poll based on the rest of the race. We see that so many places this race is tightening up. It's tightening up nationally. It's tightening up swing states. And then Louisiana, a state that was already pretty Republican, has gotten seemingly more Republican after Katrina, although that's changing back a bit, has never been anywhere in play, if you will. And now it's a six-point race. You're thinking, is this a bad poll? Or does this make you question some more of the other numbers? Catherine, what do you think about the Louisiana race in contrast to the rest of the nation?
I'm not real. I think there's a lot of unhappiness in Louisiana. They're having all kinds of economic problems, and I think Bel Edwards is doing a good job, but I think he's also facing some criticism. So I'm not surprised that we're seeing unexpected or unusually it almost seems like random polling out of Louisiana. So it's not really a surprise to me.
Yeah. Tim, what do you think of this poll?
Well, you know, like you, I was looking around everywhere for some for something about this, and I just can't seem to find it. He ought to be further ahead in Louisiana than that. You know, we've made allusion to Katrina. All the people who left that state and didn't come back were Democratic voters, basically.
9 out of 10, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, there should be no way it should be this close. Because we've been seeing polls of that Senate race down there, and it looks like the Republicans have that well in hand. I just couldn't imagine how Trump would only be 6 points ahead in a state that would be made for him to win by double digits. And like Nate Silver on his side is showing Trump ahead in Louisiana by double digits, 11, 12, 14 points every time I go to his site. So let's say this one's an outlier until we get some more info to back it up.
Just one theory on this one, and then Catherine, I'll ask you this one first. David Duke has injected himself into this race, probably more so than the last few cycles. I don't know. I guess he sees an opening with Trump or Trump supporters. Louisiana is, by and large, pretty embarrassed by David Duke. I mean, I'm sure he has his following, but it's safe to say that's not a majority of Louisianans. Do you think maybe that they're so embarrassed by Duke and the fact that he's tried to attach himself to Trump that a sliver at least of those generally Republican-leaning voters are holding out on Trump?
That very well could be. I would think that might hurt Trump. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Tim, anything there to the David Duke connection?
No, I don't think so. I'm sitting here right now looking at Silver's site. He just updated it an hour ago, and he is calling Louisiana for Trump by 16 points.
Oh, my God.
And this guy don't miss. He don't miss much at all. I've just got to believe that this poll is just way off, and I don't know what they've done. I wish we could get to the crosstabs on this poll if we could find it, and then we might know if they oversample somebody or undersample somebody or how they conducted this poll or what they did. But I'm still going to call outlier and say that Silver's right.
I have seen a few things. I did see the Senate numbers related to that. It showed that a Republican and a Democrat, I believe it's Buddy Foster, it's Foster Campbell is the Democrat. He's probably going to be the number two finisher, which means he'll make the general, which I believe that means the runoff then, I guess, say the general, but I believe they don't really have a guerrilla primary. That is Election Day. So there's a good chance that that could go into overtime, if you will, which I believe is still December there. They hadn't done the crazy run we
December.
Have.
It is December.
Where ours
it
are going to
December.
January, which is nuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's December. So that kind of went in. Also, it did show, I saw somewhere, that John Bel Edwards had about a 51% approval rating. So at least the sample might have been consistently bad, but it did jee-haw between those numbers. And that one thing I want to mention to y'all about John Bel Edwards is I know y'all remember, I'd want to bring up that Louisiana race. I'd bring it up with guests, and everybody kind of think I was a little crazy wanting to talk about this race. And lo and behold, John Bel Edwards is the Democratic governor of Louisiana,
yeah,
and
but,
he won in a non-presidential year.
Yeah, but
there's more progress in Louisiana than there is a lot of southern states.
That was a very special situation. We know what happened there. There was a very
unpopular Republican. Sound familiar?
But he suddenly became a not very popular Republican. So
that's what I mean. He was an unpopular. David Vitter was unpopular. He had baggage. Donald Trump has baggage. Now, I'll say this. John Bel Edwards was an undefined or maybe likable candidate, and the Republicans have defined Hillary Clinton in a different way. There's not as much vacuum there. So I will say that's different. But I just think it's a good race to look at because, maybe the Republicans have to spend some time there. And if somehow you could push Foster Campbell into that runoff, even if it's a long shot, if the Senate is, virtually tied, it at least gives you an opportunity to win, albeit not a good one, but an opportunity. And Mary Landrieu did win in 2002 one of these runoff situations. So it seems like something that I'll explore. If I were the Clinton campaign, I would put a poll in the field in Louisiana if I hadn't done one. Just to check. Catherine, would you do that?
I would definitely do that.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see.
See if this is an outlier. Wait
if
for somebody
else
to
will
do
poll
it.
For you. Yeah. Yeah, see if somebody else will poll for you. But then I think I've been told the campaigns do better polls now than
okay,
by and large
now look,
media sources.
Look.
What do you think,
here's two other polls. JMC Analytics, Trump 16, and then WWL-TV, Trump 8. Throw those two together, you got a 12-point lead,
Yeah.
The JMC Analytics poll was of likely voters, so I'm still thinking that no one.
Well, it was a noteworthy conversation, and now even more noteworthy, we got our guest coming in on the program. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine from Politico, Mr. Glenn Thrush. Welcome, Glenn.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Oh, good to have you on. Well, Glenn, first off, we kind of thought, we're going to go in this direction, but something happened today, and we know you're one of the top reporters in politics, and obviously a reporter that has a long track record with First Lady Hillary Clinton, and so an incident happened at the 9/11 event. Tell us what you know that might not be just the, what we can read off of other news sources.
Well, I'm not sure I have a ton of insight apart from the fact that, she clearly had a health incident. And it probably wouldn't have been very significant had there not been one or two of her fans standing near this van taking cell phone video of her as she stumbled and appeared to really wobble on her legs. To an extent that, it appeared as if she was about to pass out. But I think it's much more interesting, guys, to look at the way her campaign handled it as opposed to the details. There was her doctor tonight came out with a statement saying that she suffered from pneumonia, was diagnosed last Friday, is on antibiotics, dehydrated. But her campaign didn't answer a single reporter's questions. We had dozens, Politico reporters had really literally dozens of inquiries into various people. They penned the press in at Ground Zero for an hour to 90 minutes without informing them that Hillary had gone to Chelsea Clinton's apartment in Manhattan. And then when they were shipped up, then Hillary left her protective detail meaning the protective press pool detail, the people who follow her around all the time, and went back up to her home in Chappaqua. Then the press was escorted up there, again, given no information as to what happened other than a statement saying she'd been overheated. Then they were sent to a hotel and waited for 2 to 3 hours for a press briefing until finally they were told around 5 o'clock this afternoon that Hillary Clinton had suffered from pneumonia. My question is, and I think the question that's going to be asked a lot in the next couple of days, is why did it take them so long to at least get out some of that basic information when it seemed very clear from the outset that that Hillary Clinton had been suffering from this particular illness. So it might turn out to be innocuous, and I have no reason to doubt their account of this, but in an environment where people are already fostering suspicion about her health, this adds to that.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm going to ask you a quick follow-up on this. How many days, just speculating, do you think this will be in the news cycle?
Well, look, that's a great question. That's a question the Clinton people are mapping out right now, I bet, right? That's the critical question. If she recovers well, if she talks about this with candor, and if I think both candidates, by the way, need to release their medical records, you know, Trump, ironically, more than Clinton, even though Clinton has had this event occur, she's released more information, and Trump's stuff has been farcical. You know, the doctor, and people interviewed the doctor who did this, he said he basically wrote it in crayon on the back of an envelope because he figured it was what Trump wanted to hear, right? I think if she bounces back from this, keeps some of her schedule up, but takes care of herself, appears in public, gets her strength back, I think this won't be anything more than a marginal issue. But, you know, it doesn't do any good optically for a candidate to be seen as physically vulnerable. It's just a bad thing, and it's hard to see how this is going to impact the race eventually.
Yes. Well, I'm going to kind of flip my questions up to stay on Hillary Clinton. And one thing that's kind of struck me about this campaign is everybody that says, you know, this campaign's so fascinating and everybody thinks about Donald Trump. And probably all of us that live through it 5 years from now, 20 years from now, are going to remember it. Oh, yeah, all the stuff that Donald Trump did. But 100 years from now, when people read about it in the books, they really, you know, Donald Trump, maybe they know who he is. They're going to, if Hillary Clinton wins, and she's still the favorite, it's going to be the first election of a female president. It's going to be a historic thing. Why is that not covered more? And then tell me something.
I am so happy you said that. I actually had a conversation with John Dickerson, you know, the moderator of the CBS Sunday morning roundtable show, right? And Dickerson made the argument that nobody is going to remember Hillary Clinton, that they're going to remember this as the Donald Trump election. That's nonsense, man. We've had, you know, we're 0 for 44 on female presidents. This is an epical undertaking. And frankly, it is a measure of how people's opinions on Hillary Clinton have hardened over the years, that they can't really see it. I mean, the most retweeted tweet of my entire life was on the eve before she announced, before June 7th, the eve before she won the California primary, which clinched the primary season for her. I said, hey, folks, by the way, we're about to nominate the first female presidential nominee of a major party in our country's 240-year history. That's not nothing. So, guys, I agree with you 100%. I mean, Hillary is the story of this election, and Trump will be a sideshow in history.
Yeah, I mean, it's not contrast. I mean, obviously, we all lived through 2008, the first president that was a man of color. And honestly, in 100 years, white, black, Hispanic, Asian are probably going to be more like each other racially. If you look at it, we're going to just become more like each other racially. But I don't think men and women are going to become more like each other genetically in the future.
Well,
I think
you want to know something?
That's going to be more of a thing.
My cousins are researchers at Duke. You'd be surprised what they're coming up with in the lab.
Yeah.
Who knows? But, you know.
I think where this is important. You know, it's really funny. I've been having a lot of conversations lately with demographers and academics who've sort of been studying this phenomenon of, you know, the decline, for instance, in white male lifespans, right? And what's going on throughout the country in terms of the sense that white working class people have of being hopeless. And whoever the president is, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, this is an issue that definitely needs to be addressed by everybody. And I think it will go down as one of the failures of the Obama administration. But I think apart from the Clinton phenomenon, what we do have to recognize is we are at a real crossroads in this country, and there is a substantial portion of the electorate, and you guys know this very well, that feels as if they are totally left out on the sidelines. And we've got to figure out a way as a country to integrate people into this process so they do not feel so separated. I just feel we are in a period of division. I mean, even today, guys, as we're watching the opening of the NFL, and I'm not making a comment on people's political expression. They can say what they want. But, you know, there were some political protests today in the NFL, on the opening day of the NFL. And it just illustrates, I think, the extent to which individual groups of people are viewing themselves as separate and not part of the larger American family. And I think we are going to have to, whoever becomes president, Trump or Clinton, is going to have to address that because these divisions are really killing us.
Well, Glenn, it's funny you bring that up. You need to go back and listen to the first part of the show. I was at the Falcons game. You'll be glad to know it was very unified there. People of all races hate Kyle Shanahan's play calling, in addition to everybody honoring the 9/11.
Well, I'm here in D.C., fellas, and
moment.
The Shanahan family is not very – I don't think anyone's buying those guys any steak dinners here anytime soon.
Yeah, well, I will ask you one more question, and then I'm going to share after that, and that would be – now, we had you on before Donald Trump was the nominee, and
yeah.
Since that time, it seems like he has made more outlandish statements than many presidential candidates combined, yet he just won't go away. I can't list them all or I'd take up the rest of the show. How is he so resilient?
Because people, and sometimes it's very simple, okay? Now, it's funny, a poll came out today, Washington Post poll, it showed Barack Obama at 58%, right, which is almost inconceivable considering how low he was in his first part of his second term. But the simple reality about this is we have had the same party in power for 8 years, and people want a change. And Hillary Clinton is probably the candidate in our immediate lifetime who least represents change. So you have a candidate right now in Hillary Clinton who is most out of step with the mainstream of the American political movement. And I'm talking about not just kind of the smaller subset of people who support Trump, but if you kind of pull the Trump supporters together, pull the Sanders supporters together, throw in some of the other Republican candidates, you're talking about a substantial part of the country that wants change. So regardless of Hillary's own history, and she has a long one, a lot of people just simply want change, and she can't represent that. And that's why you saw, again, in a couple of the polls that came out today, and they were not terrible for her, by the way. She still has a solid advantage. But what you see are that Democratic supporters are now less enthusiastic about going to the polls than Trump supporters are. There are fewer Trump supporters, but they're more enthusiastic. That's a big problem. She's got to deal with that.
Yes. Well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Tim, and he'll pass it to Catherine, and then we'll kind of close up our interview with you. Tim?
Good evening, sir. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, how's it going?
I know you'll know this expression, take out the trash day. Well, obviously that refers to the Friday news cycle historically. Well, not this past Friday night when Secretary Clinton caused quite a stir with her basket of deplorables remarks.
That would be more take out the white trash night.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, God. Get you guys with that one.
Yeah, oh, God, let me get my composure.
Yeah,
right.
We are in Georgia.
Is this her 47% moment, or will this affect the race in any meaningful way?
Well, she's awfully lucky that she nearly fell down because now nobody's talking about that. No. Look, I don't think that is for a couple of reasons. First of all, it actually feeds into her, unlike the 47% comment, that comment actually galvanizes Hillary Clinton's base. And even though it's a criticism of her, gets them, her campaign, talking more about the thing that they want to talk about, which is Donald Trump and the crazy things that he says. So I think in that sense, it's not terrible. The other reason I think it's not comparable is a matter of arithmetic. When Romney made the 47% comment, he was talking about a percentage of the United States. Hillary Clinton
mm-hmm.
was talking about a percentage of Donald Trump's supporters. So she's really insulting people who wouldn't necessarily go for her anyway. Now, mm-hmm. mind you, it's not a good thing. It was a big gaffe. She had to clean it up quickly. But in general, I think it is damaging only insofar as this narrative of her campaign teetering and her having trouble it takes root. So I think if she's able to move forward, again, this is all about performance, just like your Falcons, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's got to play the game. If she has if she has a really good debate in 2.5 weeks, we're not going to be talking about any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's flash forward and think the unthinkable. And that is that Donald Trump is elected. Now, we have heard all of these stories and theories about what will the Republican Party do after Donald Trump loses? How will they reinvent themselves? How will they go forward? What if Hillary Clinton should lose? What does the Democratic Party do? Where do they go from here?
I don't think the Democratic Party is facing an existential threat if Hillary Clinton loses. It'll just be a validation of the fact that they chose the wrong nominee.
Mm-hmm.
I think to a certain extent, Hillary Clinton represents the last of her generation anyway. And remember, the issues that Clinton really represents, rather, let me put it another way, the problem that some Democratic voters have with Hillary Clinton is really not ideological.
Mm-hmm.
She changed during the race. Yes, she represented, over the years, she represents the face of Wall Street a little bit more. She moved on trade. But in general, the ideological spectrum that the Democrats represent is pretty tight. So, to some extent, it's a natural cleaning out of a generation that would have taken place had they surrendered power to the Republicans anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think a more interesting question to me is what happens to the Republican Party if Donald Trump wins? I think you are going to see the core of opposition to Trump initially on issues like immigration and even on
mm-hmm.
issues like trade is going to spring from some members of his own party, particularly in the Senate. Now, there is a honeymoon period when a president is elected, and congressional leaders are not courageous people. They will respond to what the presidential electorate does. But it's my suspicion, as time goes by, the honeymoon's going to be real short, and the conflict between Trump and the rest of his party is going to become more acute because there really is a huge ideological divide between him and his leadership. So the paradox here might be more damage could be long-term done to the Republican Party by Trump winning than Trump losing.
Wow. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I haven't thought about that. All right. We're in the state of Georgia here. White voters in the state are voting at a rate of about 4-1 in favor of Republican candidates. Now, and that's pretty much the norm across the South. How can the National Democratic Party attract these voters again?
Well, you said non-black voters.
Yes, sir. White voters.
White voters. That's
yes.
a great question. And, the irony here, of course, is that was Bill Clinton's project in 1992
mm-hmm.
with the Democratic
mm-hmm.
Leadership Council.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that the Democrats were focused on. But the Obama election, the success of the Obama coalition, is all about deepening voter turnout among the base groups. And this is a party right now, the Democratic Party, whether Hillary Clinton wins or loses, has a fairly sustainable grip on the White House based on the coastal elites, educated people in the coastal areas, California,
mm-hmm.
New York, down the corridor. And the encroaching, as you see in the state of Georgia, Georgia and North Carolina are moving rapidly in the same direction, I think in terms of education and in terms of political movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing these long-term movements in the Democratic Party that intensifies their recruitment of educated whites and typically urban blacks, right? So that is a coalition
mm-hmm.
that is successful electorally. Back in the early 90s when Bill Clinton was running around, you really needed to get middle-class, middle-income, working-class whites as part of that coalition. You wouldn't get anybody elected. So the problem for the Democrats is they may want to reach out to these groups, but those are not the people who get them elected. And the name of the game right now, unless this theory of the case, which was propagated by President Obama and his team, is wrong, the name of the game right now is deepening turnout amongst African Americans and the elites, and that's what they're focused on, not necessarily crossing over. So I think that is a fascinating question, and it really raises it really raises some questions about whether or not the old Roosevelt coalition, if it's possible to sort of bring back, unite people based on economic class and economic interests as opposed to kind of race and geography, right? Education.
Excellent answer. Thank you, sir. Catherine?
Hello, good evening. Thank you so much for being on tonight, Glenn. We really appreciate it.
No worries.
I have a couple questions. I want to go back to what you,
you guys are great,
talked
by the way.
About
I mean,
earlier.
I'll just tell you something. I do this for a living, and I don't prepare this much.
You talked earlier about the importance of sort of unifying us as a nation or feeling like we're part of a community, and I absolutely agree with you 100%. I think that's a really big problem and something that I have thought about and sort of worked towards in my political volunteer activity for a long time. So there's that. And then there's this, what you and Tim were just discussing, this, you know, well, we really need to only focus on African Americans and the coastal elites in order to get elected. So I think we have a problem in that the work that needs to be done to make the country sort of stronger and more unified is really maybe not political work or electoral work. So how do we unify the country but still get Democrats elected?
I mean, again, you guys are you're answering your own question. I think that's absolutely. I mean, we're talking about, you know, it is, and that is the frustration of being a political reporter. I wasn't a political reporter all my life. In fact, I started off in Birmingham. You know, I think I've told you guys this, right? I started off working for the Birmingham Post-Herald,
mm-hmm.
covering rural poverty and education reform. And when you look at those issues from the ground up, from sort of the social and economic and sort of educational issues, you have an entirely different vantage point on why people come to these conclusions politically, right? We tend to view things from this, like, top-down, particularly here in D.C., from this top-down political viewpoint where we view people as chess pieces on a board. But the truth of the matter is these are organic communities that are constantly evolving, right? They're kind of, right now, particularly in the South, whenever I travel to the South, I'm always struck by, like, going to Spartanburg and Greenville, for instance. You're just struck by the fact how these are communities that are kind of being pushed and pulled between the past and the future, right? Kind of hard to figure out what the present is when they're being pulled by the past and the future. So I do believe that you've got to have a sense of cohesion. And this is going to sound like a crazy thing to say, but one of the biggest failures of the Obama administration, you guys are going to laugh at me at this, was failing to fund NASA. Now, why is that important? Well, because NASA was a hugely unifying political institution, social institution in this country. People sat around their TVs as a country and watched this stuff and felt a pride in what the country was accomplishing because we had a unified mission. No one really sat around. There's no Republicans and Democrats and blacks and whites when, you know, when Neil Armstrong was walking on the moon. And I think the Obama administration missed an opportunity to develop these unifying national institutions. And I think whoever becomes president has got to figure out a way to weave this tapestry back together institutionally. And also, the other thing about this, and you guys know this too, is our politics is a lot more acidic and bitter than interpersonal relationships that we witness in our daily lives, in churches and in businesses. There's a lot of strife. I'm not going to soft pedal this stuff, and there's a lot of friction. But, you know, my experience in going around the country and talking to actual people is that there's an awful lot of good stuff going on. And our media, and I'm part of this, only focuses on conflict and negativity. So I can't believe I'm saying this because my whole career has been pointing in the other direction. But we need to find that national institution. We need the media to pay attention to the good stuff that's going on.
I'll agree with that. My next question.
Sorry, it was long.
No, that was great. No, that was very good. So there's a big financial difference or fundraising difference between Trump and Clinton. I looked at the July numbers. We kind of know what the August numbers are, but it's big. I mean, she's got like, you know, 300 and probably close to $500 million right now, and he's got somewhere around 200 million, I think.
Right.
Maybe a little more, but. And so how in the next, what are we at? We're at like 59 days now, I think.
Yeah.
In 59 days, how are they, how is that going to – what is the impact of that extra money that the Clinton campaign has? Well, I mean, that's combined with, you know, some of the 501c, some of the other groups. But
right.
How can she use that money to make an impact? And what is that going to mean for Trump? Is he going to have to dump a bunch of money in Georgia? Because she's dumping money in Georgia. And so how does that money difference, what is the impact of that going to be, do you think?
Yeah, and by the way, you know, I was up in Brooklyn for a three-day visit last week, and I talked with a bunch of people up there. And I don't think the Georgia stuff's a head fake, guys. I mean, I think they're doing serious phone banking. I don't think they're putting tons of resources in there. But
well,
I don't
we've
think
got organizers
and yeah,
we've got organizers in offices. Everybody's whining because we don't have yard signs. Well, yeah, yard signs don't win elections. So.
No, but I mean, I think they're
shut up and
I
get
mean,
on
you, know, you guys were referring to some polling that I hadn't seen, but I think. It's close enough for them to devote resources. Look, you know, I suspect if this goes according to form that, you know, you're going to see more of a spread as time goes on and maybe they'll disinvest. My sense is they're going to bet the house on North Carolina. That's really, if they can win North Carolina from Trump, he's got no chance. But we have a raft of polls today showing that New Hampshire, where she was up by 12 or 15 points like a month and a half ago, is now competitive. So where the money's going to be spent. So the money, the one thing, the two things that the Clinton campaign has, and actually they have a ton of advantages, but institutionally, but the two places where they really, really have an advantage are the analytics, where they've got a 60 to 70 person team doing real analytics. And for those folks who don't know what that is, that just means they can do these incredibly sophisticated voter profiles where they can guess with really close certainty what percentage chance that this person will vote for or against their candidate, and they can target voters. They don't have to spend money on voters who will never vote for them. And then the other thing is, as you referred to, the campaign manager for Clinton is Robbie Nook, who is a community organizer, not a community organizer, a political organizer, who did Indiana, Ohio, Nevada, and a couple of other states in 2008 for Hillary, and is widely regarded as just a very, very talented organizer who thinks about organization first. So they've got on-the-ground advantages practically everywhere. And, you know, I did a podcast with Jeff Rowe, who is Ted Cruz's campaign manager, widely respected political author, who estimated that the Clinton campaign's advantage on analytics would give a 2 to 4 point advantage nationally to Clinton. Now, the flip
well,
side of that.
Can I just interrupt for a second?
Yeah,
isn't
yeah,
that
yeah.
one of the things that they said was the big part of the big win for Obama was he had this like team of analysts in a room that just could, you know, go down to county, street, house and
oh, yeah,
figure
again,
out how.
We're not talking about county and street. When you get explained, you know, I had people sort of give me a demonstration of some of the stuff. You know, they do things like 8 or 9 data points where they, you know, where they are now able to model people's it's kind of creepy. People's electoral behavior, like within an inch, and I mean it is really something. So yeah, the Obama people and David Plouffe, again, somebody else who I talked with quite a bit, is Obama's campaign manager, kind of his guru on this stuff. Estimated that the level of detail they have on voters is now 4 to 6 times greater than it was in 2008. So it's exponentially, and it's all because of the cloud, by the way, cheap data storage. So they're able to aggregate more information. The flip side, though, is Trump's mastery of what we call earned or free media with cable and the networks. And I think we saw that on the security summit last week where Matt Lauer very much, I think, thumbed the scale in favor of Donald Trump, really let him off the hook on a lot of things and kind of spent 45 minutes grilling Hillary on emails. So Trump, and again, as proven kind of in today's news cycle, Trump is the master of getting free publicity. So I think her advantage in terms of money is cut into by Trump's mastery of that process.
Yeah, I watched the Good Morning America for about half an hour every morning, and he is on every day. Every day. I'm like, really, every day. But I wonder if part of that is just the way the Clinton campaign is. I mean, I'm not really blaming them, but I feel like they're a lot more insular. Like they don't really I think Donald Trump will talk to anybody anytime about anything, and I just get the feeling that the Clinton campaign is much more measured in how much they're willing to talk.
Well, yeah, the candidate.
You're a reporter.
Fuck, you know, I got an hour out of her in April, which was the longest interview she's given in about 10 years. And I thought she was great. I thought she could handle herself. But, you know, in the last week, she's given a bunch of press conferences. She's had the pool following her around. And look what you got. You got her biggest gaffe of the campaign with the deplorables line, and you've got this disastrous story on her health. So this is a woman who's naturally self-protective anyway. I don't think the last week is really going to do a lot to loosen her up.
I have one more question, and then I'll go back to – never mind. We're at time. Go ahead, David. Sorry.
Well, Glenn, this is an easy one that you should love. Books, podcasts, articles for Politico, anything you want to promote directly.
No, I just would love people to, you know, I would love people to listen to the podcast. It's off message. Get it at iTunes. And then the other thing is, your listenership is from a state I love. I love covering the South. You know, I love covering Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. Spent a lot of time down there. I just want people, email me at gthrush@politico.com. Comments, criticism, any news tips, any stories they think I ought to be doing. I just love hearing from everybody around the country, but particularly in the South.
Yeah, well, thanks again for being on.
All right, always great talking to you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Yes, bye. And, Catherine, good call. It was right at time, and just so glad to have Glenn Thrush on. I mean, just an excellent interview. If somebody's never listened to Kudzu Vine before, they hit 30 minutes into this one, and they don't enjoy it, they probably don't need to spend much time with us because that was just excellent. Any closing thoughts? Tim? Catherine?
Just good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah. See you next week. Guest will be Jim Barksdale running for U.S. Senate in Georgia.
Great.
Bye.
Good night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
With a strong